Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 71 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. You can like us or join the discussion at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. If you are interested in sponsoring the show as an advertiser or as an individual listener, please contact me. We could really use your support, as could PRN.FM, that assists me by providing this time slot to The Infectious Myth every week. If you sponsor the show, not only are you helping to keep it alive for yourself, but also helping to provide it to the majority of listeners that you and I know cannot or will not, for various reasons, be a sponsor. And hopefully you'll get a little buzz when I read your name on the air and thank you personally. Now to the feedback of the week. Peter from Mexico wrote, "Hi David, I like your program very much and listen every Tuesday unless I'm away from my home computer. One criticism that Peter made was that there was, continuing to quote, a virtual brush aside on the topic of psychotropic drugs." Here he's referring to episode 69 with Adam Langford on massacres with guns. "These drugs are well known to induce violence and suicidal tendencies. Gary Null says that these drugs are associated with virtually all the multiple murder-suicide incidents in the U.S. All the best, Peter." I agree that psychotropic drugs, often legally prescribed, are a cause of much violent behavior and probably much more suicidal behavior. And if you take someone with a sense of failure or grievance, combine it with psychotropic drugs, coded messages from the mainstream and fringe right-wing media, and possibly alcohol, and then throw in a powerful gun, you have an accident waiting to happen. I can't say that every incident of major gun violence is due to these causes, but it certainly needs to be taken more seriously. Let me rephrase that. It needs to be taken seriously because at present, society generally ignores this problem. Simple equation: illegal drugs bad, legal drugs good. If only it was so simple. Thanks for your comment, Peter. And if anybody has a guest on this topic, let me know. Today's guest is Dr. Chris Exley. He graduated from Stirling University in 1985 with an honors degree in biology. During his final year of that degree, he undertook his first research on aluminum, or as he calls it in England, aluminium, researching the toxicity of aluminum to salmon in acidic waters. He completed his PhD at the same university in the Institute of Aquaculture, funded by ICI. That research was titled "Amelioration of Aluminum Toxicity in Atlantic Salmon, with particular reference to aluminum-silicon interactions." Then he had a 3-year postdoc fellowship in the Institute of Aquaculture, also sponsored by ICI, and moved to Keele University in the summer of 92 as an ICI research fellow. He helped establish the Unit of Inorganic Chemistry and Material Science in the Department of Chemistry. In 1994, he was awarded a Royal Society University Research Fellowship in the Bio-Inorganic Chemistry of Aluminum and Silicon. He's a professor of bio-inorganic chemistry at Keele today, where I reached him. Welcome to the show, Dr. Exley.
Yeah, thanks for asking me.
So one of the first things I noticed about this was your sponsorship by ICI, which maybe we should talk about a little bit later, because I'd first like to introduce people to the concept of aluminum toxicity. And perhaps people will understand the association of a chemical company with those ideas after we've talked a little bit more about it. One of the points you make is that aluminum is not used in biological systems. Is that a correct assumption?
Yeah, well, as far as we know, and many of us have looked long and hard over many, many years, we have not managed to find any biochemical system, biological system, or indeed any organism that actually requires aluminium. In other words, that if aluminium was taken out of their environment, then if it was a plant, for example, it wouldn't grow, or if it was an animal, it would die, etc. So it is completely non-essential, if one can look at it in an alternative way. But actually, if you look a little bit deeper into this, what you find is there's actually no evidence of any biochemical system or biological process which actively uses aluminium for any purpose. In other words, I often describe when aluminium moves into an organism or into a biological environment, I often describe it as like a silent visitor, because biochemical or biological systems simply do not recognize this particular metal, neither as being essential, nor really as being specifically toxic, in that, for example, there are some non-essential metals which, I mean, I take off the top of my head something like cadmium,
mm-hmm.
which if you were to come across that, if you were, say, unfortunate enough to eat a sandwich that contained a little bit of cadmium, and that cadmium went into your bloodstream via your gut, actually your body would start to produce particular proteins which are known to bind cadmium and help to remove it from the body. So the body, or your body, seems to have a memory of cadmium having visited it before.
Or maybe cadmium just looks like something else. I read some research where manganese displaces copper in the brain, according to some research, because I guess manganese to the body looks enough like copper that if there's enough of it, it can...
You're confusing two things in many ways, because you're talking about, obviously, manganese and copper are both essential metals, and there are processes already in place, homeostatic mechanisms, to deal with the presence of those and to use them efficiently.
Right.
Something like cadmium, which has absolutely no function whatsoever, the body would still recognize it. It still has a process which suggests it's seen it before in the evolutionary process, and it's selected it out of biological processes. The reason I brought this up is that when aluminium gets inside you, you don't have that. There is no obvious or clear response to the presence of aluminium. And I think in many ways that's what makes it sort of more insidious. It makes it more of a potential danger, because there is no obvious homeostatic mechanism to deal with it.
And, I mean, a lot of compounds that are toxic are only toxic in certain forms. Like mercury, for example, the metal mercury, my understanding, and you're the chemist, so you tell me if I'm wrong. My understanding is that metal mercury is less toxic than the ethyl and methyl mercury. So is there a similar situation with aluminum?
Yeah, where, you know, one of the difficulties in understanding how particular types of metals can bring about toxicity is that when you, so the argument, let's say, about methyl mercury, why would methyl mercury be more toxic than the free mercury cation? And the answer actually is that it isn't. The answer is that it's a lot easier for methyl mercury to both get into the body and travel around the body,
mm-hmm.
whereby it can give up at some point the free mercury 2 plus metal, which can then produce toxicity.
Right.
So you're nearly always, when you talk about particularly metal toxicity, you're nearly always talking about the free metal being the most toxic form. And then different forms in which you find metals can change the availability of that free metal cation, so they can help them to move around the body more easily,
right,
or something of that sort.
Okay, I understand. So what's the normal form of aluminum, like in soil? Because it's a very common element. It's all around us.
The Earth's crust is made of three elements: aluminium, silicon, and oxygen. So, you know, we are walking on something made of essentially an aluminous silicate.
Right.
So the vast majority, 99.9999% of all aluminium on the Earth, is contained in the rocks which make up the Earth's crust. And essentially, it's only when that metal, in some way or other, releases a form of aluminium which can then release the free metal Al3+, that you potentially have problems. So you mentioned in my sort of biography of my work on fish, the reason why aluminium is toxic to fish, or why we notice the toxicity to fish, was because of this concept known as acid rain, which the acidity of rain and the inability of catchments to deal with that acidity meant that large areas, surface areas, became acidified, which meant that aluminium could be leached out of completely inert stores and into things like lakes and rivers. And then you had the Al3+ available, for example, you know, to kill fish.
Right. And so by changing the form of aluminium from releasing it from the rocks, in the industrial world has released toxic aluminium into the environment.
I spent some time a while ago putting together something that I called the biogeochemical cycle for aluminium, where I tried to explain as simply as I could and you know, as well as I could for my own understanding, how we could live on a planet made of aluminium, silicon, and oxygen, how we could do that, knowing what we know now about the potential toxicity of aluminium. And you know, the simple answer to that was that while aluminium remains with silicon and oxygen, it's completely inert. It's never seen as that toxic metal cation.
Mm-hmm.
So the... I just lost my train of thought there. You were telling me, you're asking me...
Well, I said that the industrial world had released aluminum by changing it from... Yeah. So are the forms that it's normally found in aluminum oxide and aluminum silicate?
So, you know, my thesis when I started to work on this was, well, what's happening? Why, for example, do we have this now burgeoning exposure to aluminium, and in fact burgeoning exposure to biologically available and potentially toxic aluminium? And actually most of it comes down to the activity of man. So even, for example, when aluminium is released from soils because of acid rain, that's because man put acids into the atmosphere, changed the major acidifying anion from carbon dioxide to sulfuric and nitric acid, and cause the acidification of a catchment.
Right.
Also, when you get aluminium in crops and on what they're called acid sulfate soils, a lot of this is due to intensive agriculture, the way in which man farms something. But probably the most important moment in this, you know, in this particular cycle was when man learned how to take these inert aluminium ores and take them and make aluminium metal and aluminium salts. And that was only at the end of the 19th century. So that's why now I talk about us living in the aluminium age. You know, when I went to school, we had the Copper Age, the Bronze Age, the Iron Age. And for the last 100 years or so, because of man's ability to use aluminium metal, we now live in what I call the aluminium age.
And a lot of things, like airplanes, for example, it's hard to see how they would be viable without aluminium.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one thing we shouldn't lose sight of is aluminium has been an absolutely fantastic metal for mankind. Much of what we depend on today would not be possible without it. It's been a revelation.
Right.
There's no argument along those lines.
Right.
You know, my argument has never been the aluminium age is a bad thing, but my argument has often been that one should always try to do whatever one is doing or whatever one is trying to use it effectively and safely. And there should always be some sort of legislation to make sure that, that is the case.
And it seems to be, from an outsider's perspective, it seems that there isn't much concern about aluminum toxicity. But describe to me what are some of the symptoms of aluminum toxicity, and where, what are some of the environments where people are most highly exposed to aluminum in the present day?
Yeah, and again, I think, you know, this is actually something I'm writing on right now for an invited article, because, you know, if you go back to some of the heavy metals, which are known to be toxic, if you have an exposure to them, you almost certainly get ill very quickly, and there are specific symptoms that one can look out for, including, you know, the expression of certain proteins and things like that. You know, the, if aluminium is toxic, if aluminium is contributing to major sort of chronic human conditions, then it is doing so almost at a level which means that it's the symptoms of that are lost in a sort of array of other possibilities. So, I mean, I recently raised, I mean, you and your listeners will have come across certain controversies of the role of aluminium in Alzheimer's disease. And in a recent invited paper on this area, I raised the question, you know, what if Alzheimer's disease is the essentially chronic manifestation of aluminium intoxication? In other words, when do we know that we are being intoxicated with aluminium at a chronic level? You know, there are some rare occasions when people have had aluminium poisoning, and this is obvious, and it has been specifically related to aluminium exposure. Perhaps the most infamous of which would be something called dialysis encephalopathy, where people on renal dialysis in the 70s and early 80s,
right,
where tap water was used to clean people's bloodstreams because their kidneys weren't working very well.
Mm-hmm.
What happened in these situations was aluminium in the tap water, in the potable water, was dialyzed into the brains of these individuals, causing really a massive encephalopathy, a loss of neurons. Many people died from this and didn't realize what was causing it. So, you know, that provides us with the background to the neurotoxicity of aluminium, but these are rare, very rare events.
Right.
The question that we are trying to understand, as always, is what about everyday exposure to aluminium? Because aluminium is present in more or less every cell in our body now,
right,
how is that impacting? And what are, as you asked the question, what are the symptoms of an aluminium intoxication? It's not easy to come up with that. In other words, when you go to your doctor not feeling very well, he's highly unlikely to diagnose you with aluminium toxicity.
I would put a pretty low probability on that
happening. But that, it doesn't mean that you don't have aluminium toxicity. It means that we're simply not able to recognize specifically the sorts of symptoms. I mean, I'll give you one possible example is one of the... Because we are exposed to today more aluminium than ever before, and every day is actually getting higher, our exposure to aluminium in our everyday life, and because we know that there is aluminium in our body, and as I said, probably in every cell or compartment within your body has to respond to that aluminium because the aluminium is biologically reactive. But at a lower level, you know, our bodies are incredibly robust. We have multiple sort of systems that compensate and cope with many sorts of insults that we get every single day.
Mm-hmm.
But all of these systems do require energy. And aluminium is quite capable of inducing what you might think of as an energy deficit in certain areas. So one of the sort of consistent effects that we see potentially from people who we've been able to show have more aluminium in their body than one might consider to be, you know, normal, if that's possible, is lethargy, is tiredness.
Right.
And, you know, there are a number of diseases specifically related to this now, which have essentially gone unsolved. And again, we found, you know, some resolution there with respect to trying to get rid of aluminium from the bodies of people with that.
Like chronic fatigue syndrome.
Yes, exactly. Like chronic fatigue would be an excellent example.
And you also, I saw, I listened to a YouTube video, I guess, and you said that a higher aluminum content was correlated with lower sperm count.
Yes, for that. You know, one of the things that we are, we have a program here, a research program called Human Exposure to Aluminium. And essentially, we want to understand not only the ways in which we are exposed, but where the aluminium goes in the body. And we pride ourselves in probably doing the very best measurements of aluminium in human tissues anywhere in the world. And the most recent one of those was the rather alarming work looking at aluminium in male semen. And the amount of aluminium was quite, incredibly high, in particular if you consider it in relation to other bodily fluids. So, you know, you would be talking about 10 times or more higher aluminium content in semen than you might expect in, for example, the blood. So, in other words, it appears to be concentrated there. Mm. Now, we didn't find any direct evidence that this aluminium was altering the viability of the individual sperm or spermatozoa that were there, although we did see a relationship with sperm count. Higher aluminium, lower sperm count. So, yeah, there are some, but, you know, this is preliminary. We've done it once, that experiment. So it was done on 60 individuals, and it was pretty profound in terms of the results. But those are the type of things we need to follow up now. We need to know, is this a factor in human fertility, for example?
Right. Well, are there risk factors for having a higher body burden of aluminum? Like, are these people living...
Yeah.
Near industrial areas, or are they eating certain things? Like, why would people have higher aluminum content?
It's an excellent question, and I mean, apart from there are some general risk factors which probably affect everyone. In other words, risk factors in that if everyone should be able to reduce their exposure to aluminium by looking at their everyday life and changing a few things. So, for example, if you want to reduce the amount of aluminium in your diet, then you should cut down on the amount of processed foods and processed drinks that you take, because these are notoriously full of aluminium in a variety of different ways. You can cut down on things like smoking of cigarettes, which we know contains a lot of aluminium. There are many different off-the-shelf medications that people take on an all-too-regular basis, just simple things like aspirins and stuff like that, which again contain lots of aluminium. And there are many cosmetics which do too. So there are things that people can do on an individual basis. But I think what your question also alludes to is, if we've got 10 people and we're all doing exactly the same thing, does one of us absorb or retain more aluminium in our body than another?
Mm-hmm.
The answer seems to be yes.
So some people are susceptible to accumulating aluminium.
There may be some sort of genetic component which wouldn't be specifically directly related to aluminium. It would be related to another factor in the body, but which is making the body either or both, in fact, either absorb more aluminium or retain it more easily. So there are data that we've sort of isolated groups of people we call superabsorbers. We're assuming it's absorption that is greater. It could be retention that's greater. Mm-hmm. It's more difficult to measure that.
One of the risks that I don't know if I got it from you or somewhere else, but infant formula has much higher levels of aluminum than breast milk, and soy formula is even higher than cow's milk formula.
Yeah, that's our recent research. I mean, to me, it's a scandal, really. You know, the aluminium in infant formula is orders of magnitude higher than we would deem acceptable in our tap water.
Right.
It seems to be acceptable to give to the most vulnerable individuals in our society.
Well, it also raises another problem, because there's many reasons for formula to be damaging to an infant. I mean, it's not the natural milk that human infants are used to. So it would be very difficult to tease out the difference between the aluminum toxicity and the many other potential toxicities in a kind of artificially created formula.
Yeah, but you know, first of all, there are many, many mothers who have almost no choice but to use formulas. And there really has been quite a lot of very good research into the formulation of these products. And while they are not ideal or not perfect, you know, there's quite a lot of science that went into them. And I think in many respects, that's why this is even worse, in that all of the potential good that could come from the research that has gone into making good quality formula feeds for infants is potentially at least negated by then not taking account of the fact that they can be so heavily contaminated with things like aluminium, and the only reason for that is because of cost. To keep costs down, they don't want to make sure that they use a higher quality, for example, powdered milk in their preparations, or they don't want to check for aluminium in the other ingredients, or they don't want to remove it, which would also be possible. It's a cost factor which they've decided doesn't matter.
I mean, the aluminum, I guess, could come from a variety of different processes. I mean, could you get aluminum just from using aluminum machinery to process?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there are a range of possible ways in which aluminium is introduced into products like this. One is that it has been for many, many years been put into them actively because powders and things like milk powders have a general tendency to form lumps and clump together. And really, people don't want that. They don't want to open a tin of something which, in fact, is just full of big lumps that they have to break up or don't dissolve
right.
very well. Aluminium has been used very effectively and certainly historically to prevent that from happening. It's a very effective anti-clumping agent. It lines the particles and stops them sticking together. However, if you ask the companies now whether they still use aluminium salts in this capacity, they'll generally say that they won't. But actually, very, very few infant formula manufacturers, as taking them as an example, very, very few of them actually make their own dried milk powder. They buy it in. And I don't think that the same principles are applied by the people who make the dried milk powder. So it's potentially still being added. That's one possibility. But yes, you can imagine that in the processing of this, in essentially huge volumes of it, we are still using a lot of aluminium processing materials for these purposes. And then they're packaged in aluminium packaging anyway, almost exclusively, with
right.
rip-off aluminium lids and all sorts of other things like that. So there
right.
are all sorts of ways in which this could be reduced simply by, you know, well, acknowledging that this is something that we could cut down on.
Right. Well, we need to also talk about vaccines. And as a segue, I'd like to read something. I've seen this several places on the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
It says, the aluminum contained in vaccines is similar to that found in a liter of infant formula. While infants receive about 4.4 milligrams of aluminum in the first 6 months of life, while infants receive about 4.4 milligrams of aluminum in the first 6 months of life from vaccines, they receive much more than that in their diet. Breastfed infants ingest about 7 milligrams, formula-fed infants about 38 milligrams, and infants fed soy formula ingest almost 117 milligrams of aluminum during the first 6 months of life. So does that mean that we should ignore the aluminum in vaccines because even what you get in breast milk is a much higher quantity?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think those people who would like to try to negate aluminium generally as a possible problem for us like to use numbers in this way. They like to equate one particular form and one particular exposure to aluminium as being identical to any other, which is so totally wrong and ludicrous that, you know, it's non-scientific, but it is always used like this. So someone will say, oh, you get far more aluminium in your diet than you get by this procedure, so therefore it's not a problem. You know, it's just craziness. You know, one of the areas that we are actively researching is the role of aluminium adjuvants in vaccination. We're researching it from the point of view, in the first instance, of saying, well, how do these things actually work? We've used them for 80 years, and we still don't know how aluminium adjuvants work.
Well, I mean, it seems almost counterintuitive, because aluminum is, as you've said, is not used by biological systems, so you would expect it would have no impact on the immune system, but obviously it does.
Oh, there's clearly nothing more obvious, because it's so effective. I mean, in many ways, it makes me laugh, because everyone who uses it, so the vaccine manufacturers, etc., clearly use it because not only is it cheap, it actually costs nothing relative to the antigen that you're vaccinating against,
right,
but it's also incredibly effective. Now, to be effective, it has to be biologically reactive.
Right, of course.
And therefore, you are putting something into the body, either into the muscle or subcutaneously, depending on the nature of the injection, which is very biologically reactive, and then you're saying, yeah, but aluminium's not, you know, not a problem. It's inert or whatever. Of course
yes.
It's not bloody inert. I mean, you're using it for the opposite reason for this.
Right. And it's not like the aluminium is added as some kind of, to stop stop something bad happening to the vaccine while it's in the vial. It's used specifically.
No, it's not a preservative. No,
yeah.
You're thinking of things like mercury. And
right. It's an adjuvant to make the vaccine
to make
more.
Actual biological response, in other words, to actually have an immune response. Without the aluminium adjuvant, virtually no vaccine that uses aluminium adjuvant would work at all. You would have to, you would have to use such a huge amount of the antigen. First of all, the cost would be prohibitive, and secondly, you would also possibly run into problems of the danger of the antigen itself. But putting aluminium in there, you get a massive biological response. So when you have a vaccination, and everybody who gets the vaccination will get, as a minimum, a little red mark where the vaccine was added, that's not due to the antigen, that's due to aluminium.
And about 80% of vaccines, I understand, contain aluminium?
That's right, yeah, still today. Yeah, and we only really have aluminium adjuvants. I mean, most of the other vaccines don't use adjuvants. So the clinically approved adjuvants are nearly exclusively aluminium-based.
Right. Going back to the infant formula, if you ingest aluminium, do you have an estimate of like what percentage of that aluminium will be absorbed into the body versus excreted?
I mean, one of the things, of course, that there are no data yet available for infants. 0 to 12 months, and actually we've just got ethical approval for a clinical trial in this area, so we will be starting a clinical trial looking at the absorption and then excretion in the urine of aluminium from infant formulas in infants between 0 and 12 months of age. So we will have some data on that eventually over the next 12 to 24 months. So that's going to be very, 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 very interesting, because
right.
I mean, you can guess based upon what we know for adolescents and for adults that it's not going to be the case that no aluminium is absorbed. The question really is in that infant, and don't forget, in the infant, the gut is really quite premature in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't developed all of the different selective mechanisms that would potentially reduce aluminium absorption in an adult. So if aluminium absorption in an adult, and again, this is something that really the data on this is not very good, but if it was, let's say it was 1%, we'd expect it to be higher for the infant. But we're jumping ahead, and we will try to get data of that sort as soon as possible.
Well, yeah, if you consider the use, say, of a soy formula in an infant, which increases the exposure to aluminum and presumably the amount that's absorbed, if you also consider a preemie infant where the amount of aluminum in the vaccine per kilogram of weight is much higher, and you consider that some people may be more susceptible to absorbing aluminum, you could have a huge variation in the aluminum burden between a robust breastfed baby versus a sick preemie.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know whether you've got a chance to see my recent talk at Autism One in Chicago. It's online, I think. But, you know, in this talk, I make the case, you know, slightly tongue-in-cheek, but I make the case that if you wanted to design a biological system to look at toxicity of aluminium, then the infant would be your perfect guinea pig, inverted commas, because infants are completely predisposed to aluminium toxicity in so many different ways.
Right.
And that is before, you know, we actually decide that their only form of diet for 12 months will be full of aluminium.
Well, if they're formula fed,
certainly.
Absolutely. And even breastfed infants get
well, again, with a breastfed, what we then would want to know, generally we're looking at much, much lower levels, but
right.
there are individuals whose aluminium in their breast milk is very high, and this is because of their own different types of activities. There might be smokers, for example. There might be one of these super absorbers that we talked about. So, yes, there will still be some individuals who breastfeed. You know, one of the things I learned about the breastfeeding infant formula statistics from at least here in the United Kingdom is that a high proportion of mothers who... So, for example, in our hospitals, when a baby is born, no infant is given infant formula. It's not allowed.
Right.
It's against the law of
mm-hmm,
our country.
Mm-hmm.
And most mothers will say that they're going to breastfeed.
Right.
But what the statistics then show is that within a week, something like 75% of mothers move on to formulas, not exclusively, but they move on to them.
And breastfeeding advocates will always tell you that exclusive breastfeeding is, partial breastfeeding is a hugely different thing than exclusive breastfeeding.
Yeah, but I think the number of exclusive breastfeeders, I mean, we're going to recruit... I can't remember what the actual numbers are now, but we're looking at something like, I think, 25 mothers into our clinical trial that we want to run. And, you know, if we get two or three exclusive for the first 3 to 6 months, we'll be lucky.
Mm.
Never mind for 12 months, and some people talk about 2 years, but it's so rare these days to find, you know, the mothers who will exclusively breastfeed.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other story. But what you're saying is that even, quote, breastfed babies might be getting more aluminum than you'd think. And also, as you pointed out, the mothers may have widely varying body burdens of aluminum, which presumably impacts what's in their breast milk.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we want to be able to do is to do the relevant research so that we can understand the risks involved. To try to raise the capital, the funding to do these types of studies is just impossible. I mean,
why is it impossible to raise money to study the toxicity of aluminum?
Yeah, because no one in the funding areas wants to know the answer to this question. These are the question of whether aluminium contributes to chronic human disease is not something that these people want to know. Obviously, you and I might want to know, and the public in general might want to know. But if it was shown, I mean, you know, we tried recently to raise money on a crowdfunding application appeal to look at aluminium and Alzheimer's disease, because, you know, all the evidence for me points to the fact that there is a role for aluminium in this disease now, and if there is, then, you know, we have a solution to that. But anyway, if we haven't managed to raise the money for this trial, to do anything which would produce an unequivocal answer, which would be a benefit to everyone, you're talking like a minimum of £500,000, so
moving
on for what, $800,000 or something like that. And that's just to do the basic and most simple but unequivocal type of experiment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, we could not, we would could not raise that money in any other way. We could not get it from the normal things like our medical research council. We would not get it from places like the Alzheimer's charities. And the reason being is that if aluminium was implicated in a disease such as Alzheimer's, or indeed any other chronic condition in humans, but Alzheimer's would perhaps produce the most response, I guess, you know, the world would actually have to change because of this. Because it is the way in which we use aluminium is now so ingrained within our everyday life. We use it in so many different ways. There is absolutely no legislation whatsoever to protect us from our use of aluminium. So therefore, many, many things would have to change.
Right.
Many things. And, you know, stock markets would crash to begin with.
Well,
take some time to recover.
I listened to your list of you know, exposures to aluminum, thinking that, you know, most of those I'm not exposed to. I don't take antacids and even aspirins and things like that. So, I mean, it would not be impossible to change people's lives, to be aware that certain compounds had high levels of aluminum, to remove the aluminum from them, things like that.
Nope.
Are there, one of the things that you said, two things you said related to the excretion of aluminum were the importance of sweat and also silica. So can you explain how those would actually reduce?
Yeah, I mean, obviously one of the things that we are interested in doing is to try to provide a non-invasive protection against the possible toxicity of aluminium. And coming all the way from my original PhD research showing that silicon protects against aluminium toxicity in fish, we are also able to show over the last 10 years or so, maybe more, losing track almost, but that if you drink a silicon-rich mineral water, you produce aluminium in your urine. And we've been able to do a number of small projects now with people with Alzheimer's disease, with healthy volunteers, with a number of other diseases. We've got a trial ongoing at the moment with multiple sclerosis, where we're able to show that this is an effective way to get aluminium out of your body. That was actually the basis for our crowdfunding appeal, where we wanted to test the aluminium Alzheimer's hypothesis by getting a large number of individuals at the very earliest stage of Alzheimer's to drink silicon-rich mineral waters every day and look at whether the progression of their disease was altered, because that would give us an indication of the role or not of aluminium in the disease.
One of the things I've thought of with, you know, as people get older, they tend to consume more pharmaceuticals, and what you're saying is that those pharmaceuticals often have a high level of aluminum.
That's right.
So this could, you know, this sort of what they call polypharmacy, it might not just be the drugs that are, you know, producing a burden of disease, but also some of the unintended things like aluminum.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. I mean, there is even the situation where one of the more heavily prescribed drugs for Alzheimer's disease, which is something called an anticholinesterase inhibitor, a drug that's been prescribed for Alzheimer's for decades now.
Right.
A drug which had absolutely no effect, but it's something that's prescribed.
Well, it does have an effect on the bottom line of the drug companies, so therefore...
Well, yeah, a huge effect there. But actually, in one of those products, the manufacturer adds aluminium because they use aluminium to color the outside of the tablet.
Really? Well, that's an important usage.
So this is a company who really are just putting up, as we say in English, two fingers to the aluminium Alzheimer's story. They're saying, we don't care one iota about that. We're putting aluminium into a drug for people with Alzheimer's disease.
All right, so they would be really interested in supporting aluminium toxicity research. Right?
This just shows the complacency that's out there. Right. But the fact that they are able to do it also shows the complacency in our regulatory authorities,
yes,
in our governments. No one is willing to do anything about this because of the power of the aluminium industry and associated companies.
Well, what do they call it when you believe two contradictory things in your mind? Cognitive dissonance. They're saying that aluminium is important in vaccines because it's biologically active, and they call it a vaccine adjuvant, and then they say it's biologically inert. Therefore, we can put it in anything in any quantity, and it shouldn't be a problem. Now, sweat, does that mean that people who exercise a lot would end up with a lower aluminum burden?
This is an area of research that is still relatively preliminary with us, but our most recent findings are quite extraordinary in that it looks like sweating could be the major way that the body gets rid of aluminium, even more important than urine. Now, if that is the case, then yes, exercise is going to be a positive thing for the removal of aluminium.
And some of the health benefits of saunas,
Scandinavians. I mean, one of the things we know, for example, about Alzheimer's disease is that exercise is very beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
We also know that in Alzheimer's disease, the incidence is higher in women. Now, women sweat about half as much as men in the resting state.
Right.
So again, a woman's ability to get rid of aluminium via sweating is much worse than it is for men.
Oh, I see. I notice that when I get to a hot climate, I sweat much more than the locals, who tend to be a lot smaller than me, and maybe it's related to your body size.
Yeah,
your volume.
There are all sorts of reasons why many of us sweat in different ways.
Right, right.
And again, there are many different types. Well, there are several different types of sweat glands as well. And what we don't know, of course, is that they're all participating equally in potentially the removal of aluminium.
So I guess what it means is I shouldn't be so jealous of the people who can go to a hot climate and not sweat. I should be glad that I sweat a lot.
You're getting rid of your aluminium at least. You know, it raises an interesting area because a few of my colleagues, and indeed we've looked at this as well, are looking at the potential relationship between aluminium and breast cancer, and specifically the use of aluminium-based antiperspirants in breast cancer.
Right.
And of course, it raises the interesting question. Of course, an antiperspirant blocks sweating.
Right.
Now, if you are using an aluminium-based product to prevent aluminium loss in a certain area of the body in which you then find the highest incidence of tumors in breast cancer, you know, you're starting to think, now that's interesting. There's something more here than simply saying that the aluminium-based antiperspirant is getting into the tissue and causing problem. It's also stopping aluminium in a certain area of the body getting out of that tissue.
Right, and it is possible to buy antiperspirants that don't have aluminum. I do that myself.
I don't know whether they're antiperspirants. They're probably just deodorants, aren't they?
Because
aluminium is, once again, you know, a fantastic antiperspirant.
Oh, okay. So a deodorant just basically masks any body odor, but an antiperspirant actually reduces your sweating, which
reduces the sweating.
Probably not a good thing, really, when you think about it.
No, I mean, the other thing about that is, you know, the sweat gland is a very complex tissue, and it is not simply a physical blocking that aluminium does. It is actually the action of the free metal Al3+. We talked about this earlier, inhibiting the activity of the sweat gland. That is why this happens.
So you're actually absorbing aluminum through the skin when you use aluminum.
Well, it's getting into the sweat gland. It's getting into the active sites, the sweat gland is not only simply responsible for putting out sweat, it does a myriad other types of functions, and those are also being disrupted by this.
Right, right. It
so,
seems,
you know,
like
it's not such a simple thing as people think, and of course the antiperspirant companies like to tell you, the aluminium just acts like a plug, stopping sweat getting out, and this is just rubbish, and they know it.
They also imply that if you don't use their products, you will never produce children, because you'll never be able to date, so it's like, who cares about your lifespan?
Yeah, the Lynx effect, or whatever it is. Yeah.
So are there other ways that people can either reduce the intake or increase the excretion of aluminum that are relatively simple?
Yeah, there are, and this was the basis for our crowdfunding appeal. But I mean, you know, I'm sitting here at my desk, and in front of me I've got a bottle of a mineral water which is rich in silicon.
Mm-hmm.
Rich in silicon means 30 or more milligrams per liter, or parts PM, ppm silica, because it's nearly always written not as soluble silicon on a mineral water bottle, it's written as silica. Silica is actually sand, so it's a bit daft really, but it's just a conventional way of writing it. So if you find a mineral water which has more than 30 ppm or milligrams per litre silica in it,
right,
it will help you not only to reduce your absorption in your diet, but to remove aluminium from the rest of your body, in your urine, and the most latest data, which isn't yet published, so we can't be absolutely unequivocal about it, also potentially in your sweat as well. So silicon-rich mineral waters are helping us to facilitating the removal of aluminium from our body. And if you drink one just on a regular basis every day, you know, a liter of mineral water a day, which should be good for you anyway, you should be gaining some protection against, you know, potential aluminium toxicity.
And true mineral water does generally have a list of the minerals on the back,
yes,
as opposed to like soda water or something else.
Yeah, or indeed just pure waters. You know, people like Coca-Cola and others, they lots of people make just pure water. These are not mineral waters. You know, these are waters that have come through a reverse osmosis system.
Right, right.
Put into a bottle.
Okay, so we've got sweat and silicon-based or high-silicon mineral water. Are there other things that people can do?
Well, to me, apart from the precautionary type principle, which is, again, to reduce your exposure through your diet, through your activities such as things like smoking, things like long-term use of medication, off-the-shelf type medications, which many of which contain aluminium, many cosmetics and will contain some aluminium. So there are things you can do in your everyday life. I mean, you know, what I'm not going to advocate is for people to make their life a misery on the potential of not getting any aluminium toxicity. So it's a balance. I mean, I still do things that I think are necessary which involve aluminium, but I have my silicon-rich mineral water, which I believe in, every day.
Well, it doesn't sound too terrible of a life. You drink a liter of mineral water every day, you exercise, you don't smoke, you try not to use over-the-shelf medications, and you reduce your use of cosmetics. That's not a terrible life.
It doesn't sound like it. No.
And are there other things that either increase or reduce the risk that are, you know, things that people have control over?
I'm trying to think. I mean, immediately off the top of my head.
Well, formula is one, I guess.
When we published our work on this, I had literally hundreds of emails from worried parents, and I could do nothing. I could not offer them any solution to this. So, some people they have to use these products. And all we can do is, and I've said many times, is all we can do is canvass and politicians and others and try to at least get some sort of action here on this particular use of aluminium, where it clearly cannot be a good thing and is only there to cut costs, essentially.
Well, I think if there was better education on breastfeeding, because my understanding, and I've hung around some breastfeeding experts a bit, is that a lot of mothers and probably fathers too see that infants on formula gain weight more quickly, and it's not necessarily healthy, but you know, people tend to be focused on, is your infant gaining this amount of weight? And if the infant's a little under the sort of the average, which is probably biased by infants who are on formula, it's like, well, we have to give this baby something more, like, he's not gaining weight fast enough. But if people understood that, you know, for the vast majority of mothers, they produce enough breast milk, and if your baby's not in the 90th percentile of weight, that's not a bad thing, right? As adults, we don't want to be in the 90th percentile of weight. But for your baby, you want a fat baby, right?
I think that the overwhelming majority of scientific studies will always support breastfeeding against formula feeding.
Mm-hmm.
There shouldn't really be any reason for anyone to choose if they have a choice, other than convenience. And you know what we are? We are a hugely convenience-orientated population. Mm-hmm. You know, the reason why we eat the type of things we do, and we all think we're in a hurry, we all think we haven't got time for this, that, or the other. We don't want to change our lives for our children so that we can then take the milk with us wherever we go. We don't want to be embarrassed breastfeeding in public, etc., etc. It's all about convenience, I think, more than anything.
Yeah, but I think society could make it, provide more education to parents, and also accept, women should be able to breastfeed anywhere, right? It's a normal human activity. There's nothing obscene about a woman breastfeeding. Anyway, that's not really our topic of today. We pretty much run towards the end of our time, but is there anything major that you'd like to add to this discussion of aluminum?
No, not really. I mean, the emphasis should be that there are individuals like myself around the world who are coming at this subject from the most rigorous scientific standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
We are science led. We don't make comment or we don't push something unless the science has already told us, to the best of the science's ability, that this is the case. But in order to do that science, I would have to put in 20 grants to get one against one of my colleagues, simply because of the subject area that we work in. And we often have to disguise the subject area. And one of the ways in which we've started to get more funding is simply through, for example, philanthropy. And
right.
Philanthropy has helped us a huge amount over the last 5 or 10 years now in getting some projects done that would never have got done in any other way. So, I'm always saying, if there's anybody out there who really wants to help, then, we are more than happy to talk to you about it. If you've got some funding that you'd like to use or you'd like to put it into science, then, come and talk to us about it, because we really do need your help.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like an area that definitely needs more investigation, but I think you've also given people areas where they can consider their risk factors in their lifestyle and maybe make some positive changes too.
That's what we can all do now.
Yeah. Okay, well, Dr. Exley, thank you so much for talking to me today. I really appreciate all the information that you've given, and good luck with your future research.
Yeah, well, thanks for the opportunity to chat.
Okay, goodbye.
Okay, cheers, David. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 71 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or you can join the discussion there. Follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. If you would like to sponsor my show as an individual or advertiser, please contact me. Until next week.